This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. In Canada, a woman is killed every 6 days by her male partner, and about 12 women per year kill their abusers. A new book by Elizabeth Sheehy looks at the cases of 11 women who are accused of killing their male partners in self-defense. The book is called Defending Battered Women on Trial, and it highlights the barriers women face leaving their abusers, as well as the practical and legal dilemmas that face battered women on trial for murder. Elizabeth Sheehy is Shirley Greenberg Professor of Women and the Legal Profession in the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa. She is a leading scholar on the legal system's treatment of battered women in Canada. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in Ottawa.
So first of all, I wonder if you can just tell me why you felt this was an important book to write.
Well, I've been working on the issues that confront battered women on trial for a number of years, you know, maybe 25 years. I've written and researched in this area. And I've also been involved in a number of law reform efforts with respect to self-defense and, you know, reviewing the convictions of women who've been convicted for killing violent men. And I finally came to the conclusion that I couldn't get an accurate picture of what was going on for women in the criminal law, if I didn't get access to the trial transcripts. You know, I couldn't really assess whether women's convictions were just or unjust, or whether the defense had in fact aired all the evidence that was available, or whether lawyers had done a good job. So I realized about 10 years ago that I couldn't reach conclusions about whether we needed law reform, or if we needed better legal education, or if we needed better resources, until I could see what was actually happening. And so my project became, you know, to acquire these trial transcripts to be able to assess more concretely what's actually happening in the courtrooms. And from there, I knew I was going to write a book using those transcripts to share the knowledge and the information that I was gaining through getting access to the trial transcripts. And at a certain point, I decided I would write a book that would be accessible to the educated reader, as opposed to a purely academic book, you know, aimed for scholars and, you know, law students or whatever. So that became my commitment, and I decided that I should write a book that was accessible to the reading public to tell these stories, because, as you well know, there is so much misinformation about battered women in the public domain and so much antipathy that I thought I needed to share what I learned and make accessible to ordinary people, you know, the knowledge and the information and the realities of battered women's lives and challenges when they're put on trial.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what did you learn? What were some of the more powerful or impactful stories you came across in your research?
Well, one thing that surprised me deeply, I shouldn't have been surprised, but how many of the women are Aboriginal who have been involved in spousal homicide, you know, and killing violent male partners? Mm-hmm. I was deeply shocked to realize how dramatically overrepresented they are in my sample. So that was something I was unaware of. I also found it surprising to learn that there were more women who'd been acquitted than any of us knew. You know, and so I think in the end I found 22 acquittals among my files, and I thought that that was actually pretty surprising, because most of us were only aware of a handful, you know, 3, 4, 5 acquittals. So I uncovered, you know, a number of acquittals that we were unaware of, and I got an opportunity to study what those lawyers did right, you know, in terms of defending those women.
I read, you know, you said that Aboriginal women are in acute danger in Canada and are wildly disproportionately represented, both among murdered women, but also among women who kill in self-defense. You know, 12 out of the 19 women in your study who received federal sentences after pleading guilty were Aboriginal. I wonder if you can talk about that a bit more.
I was surprised to see the overrepresentation of Aboriginal women in my files. They were almost 40% of the women that I found who had killed violent male partners in the period I studied, which was 1990 to 2005. And I found that really surprising, but of course I shouldn't have been surprised, because we also know at the same time that Aboriginal women are highly overrepresented in terms of intimate femicide. They are at something like 8 times the risk of being murdered by a male partner as are other women in this country. So it's perhaps not surprising that they kill at such a high rate as well, because they are in fact in that position of facing very deadly violence. And they're also, I would say, abandoned by the state. You know, in so many of Aboriginal women's files that I've looked at, they really are on their own. There is no one who's going to help them. You know, they are on their own in terms of defending themselves and their lives and their children. If they don't do it, there's no one else who's going to do it. And in terms of federal sentences, yes, Aboriginal women are also overrepresented in my study in terms of getting the more severe sentences when they're convicted or when they plead guilty. And, you know, why is that? Well, you know, some Aboriginal women already have prior criminal records of violence. Some of those criminal records should never have occurred, but they do, because when women are countercharged with assaulting male partners, they are put in a terrible position. So many women in that position end up pleading guilty rather than, you know, stay in jail, wait for a bail hearing. They're not going to get legal aid by and large if it's, you know, the first time they've been charged with assaulting a male partner. There's an issue about what's going to happen to their kids. So most women and Aboriginal women as well will end up pleading guilty to those counter charges that are laid when there's a battering incident. And that means that Aboriginal women, for example, come then to be sentenced for homicide with a criminal record that other women may not have. And that record, of course, will exacerbate their sentences. I guess the other thing I would say to you about the Aboriginal women's files, in my the cases I found, all I think there was maybe one Aboriginal woman who did not kill in the context of a live conflict. So that's the other thing that differentiated Aboriginal women's files from the other files. Among my other files, I had a few women who killed men who were asleep or passed out. The Aboriginal women, almost to a woman, killed in the context of an ongoing conflict. Well, so if they're found guilty, you know, or plead guilty, even though they've been involved in a conflict where self-defense might have been viable, they can still be portrayed by the prosecutor as violent. If, you know, if defending themselves with violence, or if they did not, you know, try to escape the attack but rather fought back, the prosecution has the opportunity to say, and they argue this over and over again in Aboriginal women's cases, they say she wasn't a real battered woman. Therefore, she doesn't deserve the lenient sentences that other battered women might get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder if you can talk a little more about those kinds of stereotypes, like the ways that stereotypes of, I mean, both of abusers, but particularly victims of abuse, impact the way we understand and approach the issue of domestic abuse and violence against women, you know, like what a real battered woman is and, you know, what real abuse looks like and things like that.
Well, it's interesting because it's clear to me in some of these cases that the prosecution is not actually arguing that she was never abused, but they're arguing that she doesn't have entitlement to the moral ground of being a battered woman, that she, because she fought back, because she held a job, or because she had friends, or, you know, that somehow she doesn't get to assume this sympathetic label of a battered woman. And I argue in my conclusion of my book that actually prosecutors should not be allowed to make those arguments in front of jurors, that it invokes such hostility to battered women to try to suggest that they're not a real battered woman, that I think it's unfair when there is evidence of abuse. That's really all we're talking about here. You know, is there evidence of abuse? Well, then she's a battered woman. You know, you shouldn't have to fit any further criteria, whether factually or morally, to be able to say, yes, I'm a battered woman, or she is a battered woman.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously, you know, we're talking about battered woman syndrome here a lot. And I wonder if you can explain what that means.
A particular U.S. researcher, Dr. Lenore Walker, coined this term, battered woman syndrome, back in the 1970s, based on a research study that she did that involved interviewing and assessing the experiences of women who'd experienced male violence in a relationship. And, you know, basically, battered woman syndrome bears some relationship to post-traumatic stress syndrome. But what is unique for battered women is that they experience the traumatic event over and over. So, you know, one thing that ordinary people should know is that, you know, many people may experience post-traumatic stress disorder based on a traumatic event that may be a natural disaster or may be a human event that it was traumatic. But someone who is essentially captive, you know, captive in a relationship where they cannot escape, will experience, if you know, they're with an abusive partner, repeat trauma, which creates different types of responses. And so Dr. Lenore Walker has a set of criteria that she uses and that most therapists would now use to assess, psychiatrists usually, but could be a psychologist, to assess whether a woman experiences battered woman syndrome. So they are intrusive recollections of the trauma event or events, hyperarousal and high levels of anxiety, avoidance behavior and emotional numbing, usually expressed as depression, dissociation, minimization, repression, and denial, disrupted interpersonal relationships from batterers' power and control measures, body image distortion and or somatic or physical complaints, and sexual intimacy issues. One of the main consequences that she talks about is her concept of learned helplessness. And it's a concept that has been misunderstood. She is clear that she's not arguing that battered women become helpless. She says that basically when someone's efforts to escape or avoid a repeat trauma are thwarted over and over again, they become negative in their prediction of their ability to avoid or escape the violence, which may have a handicapping effect on the woman as she tries to negotiate her way out of it, you know, if it continues. So learned helplessness, she says, is not that battered women don't fight back or strategize or display courage or, you know, sometimes find ways to escape, but that their ability to predict that their actions will have the desired consequence of either reducing or avoiding or minimizing the violence or abuse has been impaired by the fact that actually she hasn't succeeded, that the man has continued or, in fact, increased his strategies of violence and control. So, you know, battered woman syndrome evidence has become relevant in law because defense lawyers will inevitably, in most of these, in these cases, have the woman evaluated for battered woman syndrome, because it then becomes a form of expert evidence that can be introduced to assist the woman's self-defense argument in her trial. That's why battered woman syndrome gets so much play in the legal arena, because it is an evidentiary or a form of expert testimony that can be used to assist her in arguing self-defense.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, domestic abuse situations, and, you know, this is obviously relevant and tied to what you were just talking about in terms of battered woman syndrome, often people will say things like, why didn't you just leave, or why don't you just leave, to women who are in abusive relationships or who were in abusive relationships in the past, and would probably say the same thing to a woman who, you know, killed her abuser. I wonder if you can respond to that. You know, what is the problem with saying, you know, why didn't you just leave?
Well, I can respond to that at a number of levels. First off, let me just talk about the law. The law does not require a woman to leave. A woman is entitled to use self-defense to defend her life or the life of her children, regardless of whether she left a man who was violent. So the law does not require that. It would be requiring a duty to retreat, or a duty of pre-retreat, you know, retreat even before you've been attacked, to entitle you to use self-defense, which would be actually a sex discriminatory imposition, because we don't require that of anybody else. You know, you're entitled to use self-defense whether or not you retreated or whether or not you got yourself out of what looks like a dangerous situation. So first off, it's not part of the law. But probably more importantly, it's actually quite dangerous for women to leave. And the most dangerous time, the time at which women face, I think it's an eightfold increase in being vulnerable to intimate femicide, is within the 18 months after a woman has left a man. So telling a woman to just leave, or expecting women to just leave, is actually putting their lives at risk and the lives of their kids. And it is simply, you know, bad advice unless the woman has had a very careful risk assessment and safety plan put in place. What happens when a woman leaves or attempts to separate from a battering and coercively controlling man is that what he does is he increases and escalates his threat. He reasserts his control, and sometimes it's at the level of, you know, if I can't have you, no one will. I win, you die. So, you know, the threat to women's lives is most acute at the period of separation and up to 2 years after separation. You know, we also don't have many guarantees. I mean, yes, shelters can protect women and save women's lives, and they absolutely do. So I'm not making that point, you know, to in any way undercut the incredibly good work and important work that women's shelters do at saving women's lives. But, you know, women can't live in a shelter 24/7 for the rest of their lives. You know, there are, nonetheless will be points where that woman is vulnerable. We have no police, we have no guarantee of police protection or response to these kinds of situations. You know, women continue to be murdered in Canada, one woman every 6 days by a male partner. You know, we don't seem to have a lot in place to protect women's lives from the criminal justice end. Women also who leave face issues around custody and access with respect to their kids. We don't place control in the hands of women so that they can, in fact, keep their children away from an abuser like this that we're talking about. So we have a problem there. You know, many battered women are mothers, and that makes them doubly vulnerable because they can't simply escape with their children without facing, you know, sanction by the criminal justice system and the family law system. And then, of course, there are all the other problems, you know, access to money, social welfare, you know, long-term housing, all the things that women need if they're going to leave and create new lives of freedom and safety.
I want to talk a little bit about the way that the media has covered your book. Because a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it seems to have almost willfully misrepresented or misunderstood some of your arguments. And so I wonder if you can just talk about and address maybe some of those representations and interpretations of your work and talk about what your actual goals were with regards to this book.
Well, first let me say that I absolutely knew that the anti-feminist women journalists would be coming after me. Mm-hmm. We have quite a number of them who have opinion spaces in the newspapers across the country. We don't have anywhere near the same number of pro-feminist women journalists, and I absolutely knew that they would be highly critical of my book. Some of them have already, in prior columns, disparaged battered women's syndrome, disparaged the self-defense claims of battered women on trial, and I've seen many of those reports already in the newspaper. So I was very aware when I published this book that it would receive negative attention, you know, from a certain part of the media, particularly the anti-feminist, pro-men's rights part of the media. I was a bit surprised by how blatantly they misrepresented what I said. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I have to say, you know, I had the opportunity to do a lot of media in consequence. I think I did 14 radio programs, plus The Current, plus Canada AM. I published several op-eds. I, you know, had many opportunities to respond and explain in a rational and calm manner what actually I was arguing and why, you know, what was being said was a misrepresentation. So, you know, I have to say the National Post said the name of my book in their newspaper at least 5 times. I thought, well, that's not bad publicity. Yeah. Even if it's negative publicity, they're saying the name of my book because it is worth talking about. So I don't resent I'm actually pleased about a lot of that media. I was disappointed that no one had read the book. That was part of the problem, right? The book hadn't yet been released. Some of those newspapers had, in fact, copies of the book, but that they didn't actually read the book. They just looked at some of the conclusions and went after my conclusions or my recommendations at the end of the book. So that was disappointing because my conclusions and recommendations at the end of the book come out of the detail, the stories in each of these chapters where I describe, you know, what happened in the woman's trial, you know, what the Crown argued, what the defense argued, who the witnesses were, what the evidence was. And so my conclusions aren't are actually much more rational if you have read the book and you can see where they come from and what I'm basing them on.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the more frustrating misrepresentations?
Well, I think the main one that has been circulated over and over again is that I'm encouraging women to kill men. You know, that's just absolutely ridiculous. You know, to be talking about women's right to use self-defense in no way is an encouragement, you know, for women to kill men. And it's very hysterical, you know, as a representation of my work or my book, and clearly untrue. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in no way advocating that anyone commit homicide. And I'm actually making recommendations that I would hope would prevent homicide. And really, my message that I've tried to get out is if we really want to save men's lives, as well as women's and children's, but, you know, if for those people who are very concerned that somehow I'm not doing justice to men's lives, then what I say to them is what we need to do is invest in women's safety. Because when women are safe, are able to exit with their children and protect their children, men do not die. You know, that is the most important message that I can get out. And that means men who are concerned about that ought to be supporting the feminist movement in this country. They ought to be supporting women's shelters. They ought to be supporting the social welfare system that allows women to leave safely, to leave those men. And those men can then live. If, you know, we know undoubtedly that men's survival rate has increased. Very few men are killed by women in this country. I think one per month is killed by an intimate female partner. So we're talking about, you know, a comparison that is not even close. You know, a woman killed every 6 days, a man killed by his wife maybe once a month in this country. So it's already a very rare occurrence, and I would say thanks to the women's movement that has assisted in providing safe exit for women. If we want to reduce men's deaths even further, again, what we need to do is invest in the women's movement and invest in safe exit for women.
Definitely. You know, and finally, I wonder if you can talk about the law in terms of, you know, how to address this issue of battered and abused women who kill their partners in self-defense. You know, what are you advocating for in terms of how the law addresses this issue?
Well, I talk in my conclusion about the fact that our law of self-defense, both at the time that I wrote my book and as newly reformed, in fact, is a pretty good law. You know, it's a law that does, I'd say, very generously allow for self-defense to be argued and gives women the opportunity to demonstrate, using evidence, their need to use self-defensive violence. So I think the problems we have that I note and that I describe in my book are not problems with the statutory law of self-defense, by and large. There are a few exceptions. By and large, that's not the problem. The problem is with the charging and prosecutorial practices. The problem is with the guilty pleas. You know, the overwhelming number of women who plead guilty, particularly Aboriginal women, they're overrepresented, again, among the women who plead guilty rather than go on for trial. And there are other kinds of reforms that I talk about in my book. But let me just say the main problem that I saw is overcharging of women. So women are usually charged with murder. Usually it's second degree, but a good number of women are charged with first degree murder. Even though, based on my data, there is really no reasonable prospect of conviction for murder of battered women. If there is evidence that the woman has experienced abuse and is a battered woman, Canadian jurors don't convict those women of murder. They convict them of manslaughter, or they acquit them. And so prosecutors who proceed with first and second degree murder charges are, I think, behaving or treating battered women differently than they treat other kinds of cases. We have a standard in Canadian prosecutorial services of pursuing prosecution when there is a reasonable prospect of conviction. And that means here that really what they should be charging battered women with is manslaughter, not murder. I'm not saying there might not be an exceptional case where a murder charge is appropriate, but by and large, there's no prospect, no reasonable prospect of conviction for murder. And by charging the woman at the level of murder, what happens is tremendous pressure is put on the woman to plead guilty to manslaughter and abandon a defense of self-defense, because it is so risky for that woman to go to trial on a murder charge. If she fails in her self-defense argument and is convicted of murder, she faces a mandatory life sentence. There's no leeway, no judicial discretion available. Even though jurors sometimes think there is, and I've seen cases where they've convicted a woman of murder and made a recommendation for mercy to the judge, the judge can't do anything. You know, so you know, one important piece of public education that should be out there is that, you know, murder carries a mandatory life sentence. If a jury convicts a woman of murder, there is no leniency that a judge can invoke, you know, to recognize the abuse or violence or the suffering that the woman went through. So women in those situations charged with murder will, the majority of them, end up pleading guilty to manslaughter and avoiding a trial and avoiding or really abdicating or abandoning what may be a very legitimate claim to self-defense. And I think that's a real problem. I think those convictions are essentially unjust convictions where women have abandon self-defense and pled guilty to manslaughter because they cannot bear the prospect and the stress and the anxiety and the emotional cost of a murder trial. And, you know, the costs of a murder trial for battered women are extreme. I mean, you know, even not referring now to the risk of being convicted of murder and a mandatory life sentence, that woman will have to testify in detail, in public, and be cross-examined on all of her experiences of rape, coercion, threat, violence. She will have to testify about what was done to her children, if something's been done to her children. Her children may be called to testify against her, and that's not uncommon. So a woman who decides, I'm going to go on trial for murder, would have to accept that her children may be called as witnesses against her, and that means her own lawyer has to cross-examine her own children, which is a devastating thing for a mother to actually be part of. And they will have to hear everyone else's account of how they don't believe her, or, you know, their own version of her reality. And, you know, the woman in these circumstances is really being put through another ordeal, really, to go through a murder trial. So it's not surprising that in those circumstances, so many women abandon self-defense and simply plead guilty to get it over with and hopefully negotiate a compassionate sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So my recommendation is, therefore, you know, charge at the level of manslaughter, not murder. I also make another recommendation, which is that we should have a statutory escape hatch for juries to recommend to a judge. So this statutory escape hatch, if a jury did return a murder verdict against an abused woman, they would have the opportunity to make a recommendation for mercy to the judge, you know, to sentence less than the mandatory life sentence. And this isn't my idea. This is actually Judge Lynn Ritushny's idea. It was one of her recommendations from the Self-Defense Review in 1997. She made this recommendation. And it makes good sense. It's not a recommendation that would apply only to women, obviously. If there was evidence of battering and abuse for another person, you know, a male or a sibling, or, you know, you wouldn't be able to statutorily limit it to women. But you could limit it to cases of prolonged or repeat trauma and abuse, that the jury would have in its hands the possibility of making a recommendation to the judge. It wouldn't be a requirement. It would be in the hands of a jury of our peers, you know, to make that recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, thanks again. Thank you so much for your time and for your work. I really am glad that we got the opportunity to talk, and your book and your work is amazing. And so thank you for that also.
Thank you very much, Megan.
You just heard an interview with Elizabeth Sheehy, author of Defending Battered Women on Trial, Lessons from the Transcripts. Thanks so much to Elizabeth for speaking with me about her work. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.